Genesis chapter 20. Last week we studied about the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah and Lot's escape from there and his eventual relocation into a cave and the sad story of how Lot ends in here. And actually, we're not going to see anything more written about Lot until we're way into the New Testament, you know. So he kind of leaves on a down note here. We've heard many comments that if we didn't have Peter recognizing him as a righteous man, we'd look at his life and think this is a person, maybe he really didn't know God. And I think that the lesson that we could learn from that is God reads the hearts. We could look on the outside of somebody's action, but only God knows the hearts. And, you know, as the old saying goes, when we get to heaven, first of all, you know, we'll be shocked and in awe of the presence of God in that place and seeing the holy angels. But I think we're going to be surprised for the people we see and the people maybe we don't see, you know, because God knows the heart. So we're now moving into chapter 20, and it begins in verse 1. And Abraham journeyed from there to the south and dwelt between Kadesh and Shur and stayed in Gerar. So Abraham now leaves that area near Sodom and Gomorrah. Remember, he was looking out and he saw the burning and the smoke. And we're not told why he leaves, but maybe, you know, being in an area that just had a cataclysm wasn't enough impetus for him to move. We're not told exactly why, but we know that in changing location, we're going to see that he runs into a time of testing again. So verse 2 says, now Abraham and Sarah, his wife, said of Sarah, his wife, she is my sister. And Abimelech, the king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. Well, this sounds like a very familiar story to us, right? Because we know that Abraham went down into Egypt when there was a famine in the land. And on the way down there, he said to his wife, listen, you know, these people don't know God here, and you're very pretty, and you're going to get down there, and if they think you're my wife, they're going to harm me to get you. So just tell them, you're my sister. And that was their agreement. So when they got down there, you know the story. Pharaoh winds up taking her into his harem. God has to now get Sarah, at that time it was Sarai, out of the trouble and Abraham out of the trouble. And here we are many years later, Abraham showing his faithfulness in his walk with the Lord. And he's now moving into another new area. And in this instance, he goes back to an old behavior. He goes back to that behavior where Sarah is not going to, he's not going to be honest and say, this is my wife, but she is my sister. Now, what is motivating this, right? We're going to see it's the same reason that he once said back in Egypt, he's afraid of the people there. And he's afraid because he thinks that they're godless, that they may do something terrible, like come in and try to kill him for his wife. So he says about her, she is my sister. And the king down there sent and took Sarah. Now, how old is Sarah? I mean, Abraham's going to be 100 years old. Sarah's in like 90 years old. It's kind of hard to imagine that a king is looking at a 90-year-old and wanting to grab her and put her into his harem. Now, some have tried to figure out a political reason maybe why he wanted her. Maybe because Abraham was a rich guy and he figures if I put her into my harem, she becomes one of my wives. I'll have a treaty with this guy and he's got a lot of stuff. I don't know. It doesn't seem that way. Because we see that later on, Abimelech was taking her as a wife there, not just like as a political captive. And so what does this tell us maybe about Sarah at this time? Well, we know that God is preparing her to have baby and be able to care for that baby. And he seems to be doing a work in Sarah and Abraham to prepare them for the job that he's called them to do. And in this instance, it seems like there is a that Sarah and Abraham kind of find the fountain of youth, so to speak, or that God provides for them, turns the clock backwards instead of forwards. And it appears that Sarah is, you know, maybe back in the bloom of her or crime. We don't know exactly, but that would explain a lot of things. God told them that they would bear children in their old age when they were beyond the capacity, normal capacity to bear children. And to do that, God needs to do a miracle, right? Well, he could bring that child miraculously through an old couple. Then you'd have an old couple raising a very young, active little baby. Now, he has servants and other people in there, but it's hard to be a dad when you're 40, let alone when you're 100, right? And to pour into that child and to spend the time you kind of that you need there. And God has a very important plan for this family, for this child, because this is the lineage through which Messiah will come. So God, in his miracle-working way, has tasked them with a difficult job. And whenever God tasks us with a responsibility, he also always gives us the ability to carry out the work that he's doing. He equips us. Many times we don't see the equipping until we're called into the work. It's sometimes he will prepare us with our life before we don't really fully understand. And here's the kind of thing here. He was talking to Sarah. He was talking to Abraham. He was telling him about this child. He told him a child would come. He never told him all the things that he was going to do, all the miraculous things. And here he's working in their lives so that they can do what he's called them to do. That means to be the father of the one who's named Isaac. Friend, did you have a question?
No.
Okay. I have the same problems. So this king now, and Abimelech, just so you all know, is not a name. That's a title. That's the rulers in that area went by that name, Abimelech. We'll see a few of them as we go through the scriptures.
No, Sarah.
Yeah, kind of like the same idea, right? So he takes Sarah and he puts her into his harem, so to speak. Verse 3, but God came to Abimelech in a dream by the night and said to him, indeed, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is a man's wife. How would you like to have that dream? Right? You're a dead man from God. That's a pretty harsh dream there. Why is he a dead man? Because he took another man's wife. Now, the law has not been codified yet. The commandment, right, that you shall not commit adultery hasn't been encoded, yet it still was wrong. The law was just God putting down for us all those things that in his mind are righteous, and he wanted us to see those things. He didn't just make them up when Moses was on the mountain. That's always was the case. God's morality starts for creation because it's part of who God is. It's a reflection of his character. And he codifies it in the law. And then Jesus will help us to understand it even more so later on, because he'll give us not just the physical part of the law, but he'll tell us that it's spiritual as well, that it counts about your motives and your thought, not just your deeds and your actions. But this was always wrong. It was always wrong to take another man's wife. And he said, you're a dead man because you've taken another man's wife. You committed a sin and you're a dead man. Yes.
He really didn't know that yet.
We're going to keep reading, right? Come right out in the next verses. Yeah. Let's read on then. But Abimelech had not come near her, and he said, Lord, will you slay a righteous nation also? Did he not say to me, she is my sister? And even she herself said, he is my brother. In the integrity of my heart and innocence of my hands, I have done this. And God said to him in a dream, yes, I know that you did this in the integrity of your heart. For I also withheld you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. All right. Abimelech's response is, I didn't know. Now, he may be innocent of adultery in the sense that he was taking another man's wife, But he's kind of going to people coming to his land and taking somebody by force, removing him from her family, putting him into her harem. I mean, what he was doing wasn't great, even if she wasn't somebody's wife, right? I don't think any of us would feel great if the king in an area came by and looked around in our household and scooped up daughters that were unmarried and just took them against their will. We think that's a pretty heinous act, you know?
He was a pagan king.
Mm-hmm.
So he really didn't have that knowledge.
Yes. Yeah. Yes and no. There, God gives us conscience.
Right.
And we understand, you know, because Paul will talk about this in Romans, that there are people who don't know the law, without the law, understand certain things of righteousness, right? They're a law unto themselves in the sense that they don't have the written law. But God puts something in our hearts that we know certain things are just wrong. Now, we can, over time, harden our hearts. We can have our conscience seared that it no longer becomes that good warning device for us. You ignore it enough, you know, it's kind of like, I remember when Sandy used to work in the hospital and I'd visit some things. And also when Rachel was first born, the nursery that they had there with all the different babies, they don't even have nurseries anymore. They keep all the babies, except for the ICU for the babies. They keep all the babies in the rooms with the moms, which I think is kind of awful. The moms are tired. They just had birth. Give them a break. Take the babies for a couple days. But I guess this is more cost efficient. I don't know. They say it's nicer. I think it's cover for saving money. But anyway, I digress. The ladies that are working, the nurses and the other people working in the nursery, right? They hear these babies crying. And I remember I was talking to one of them. I said, oh, my goodness, you must get such a headache. And she says, why? And I said, all the crying. And she says, I don't even hear it anymore. You know, it's the same thing with your conscience. If it is calling you, and you don't listen, you become hardened to that call. So there is a knowledge. Nobody is without excuse when it comes to knowing really what's right and what's wrong. And this is why God is going to hold him to this, even though, quote unquote, the law hasn't been put out yet, nor as a pagan that he was had a knowledge of the integrity of the one true God. All right. God says to him in a dream, yes, I know that you did this in the integrity of your heart, for I also withheld you from sinning against me. It's very fascinating to me that whenever we see God kind of peel back the curtain in heaven, we find out that there's a lot of spiritual activity going on behind the scenes that we're never aware of. Mm. You know, we see this in the book of Job. Right, where Satan's coming before God, and he's talking about Job, and God's gonna say to him, okay, well, you can do this so much, and you can test him so much here, and everything else like that. And God's setting limits for what he can do. Here, we're finding that this man says, I didn't do anything, I didn't touch her. And God says, yeah, I know, I kept you from sinning. That by yourself, you weren't so great that you were going to avoid sin. At any time that we avoid sin, it's by grace. It's God. It's his spirit that he indwells in us. Nobody by themselves is good. We're not capable of being good. We are utterly depraved without the ability to please God in our flesh. And it's only through God's action on our behalf we have the capacity to know him, to believe in him, to understand him, to be saved. And saying all of that, there's this portion here. He says, I know that you did this in the integrity of your heart. And he also has this little bit of human responsibility that gives him credit for. And we see all of these things playing out simultaneously. Where God is the one who keeps us from sin, yet in our heart there has to be desire, capacity, some kind of decision making that also helps to confirm the decision of God. How they meld together, not exactly sure. Find out in heaven, waiting for Jesus to teach that Bible study so I can fully get it myself. But God was behind the scenes keeping him from sin. And I think in my life, how many times when I get to heaven will I see that God kept us from sinning against him? I'll give you a quick story. I was just saved. I was maybe saved a couple of months. And in our business, there was a tenant that was actually my uncle rented some space for us. He died. It was a very tragic story. His widow came in and wanted to run the company, and she was very heavy-handed, and it turned out to be a big mess. And we were at one point, we were supposed to help buy the business when my uncle was there, but after he died, we decided not to. And it really became a very, very ugly situation. And they started a lawsuit against our company because they said we were interfering with their business, some kind of lawsuit. And as you go through depositions, right? You know, they ask you questions, and did you ever do this? And do you have this? And I think one of the questions that they asked me early on was, like, did we have any of their information, their data, their records, any of this other stuff? And no, we don't have any of theirs. Little time goes by, you know, as lawsuits, they drag out. And I was going through our basement looking for something, and I see some boxes down there that I didn't know my uncle had put down there that had some of their data and their records.
Oh,
and,
no.
And this is before I was saved. So I'm like, what do I do now? If I bring these things out now, I'm going to look like I was a liar, which would have been the right thing to do. And, you know, I just took them all, threw them in the fireplace, burned them. And it was all like little forms and stuff like that, you know, probably nothing that was germane anyway. So, okay. So I did that. I don't think about it. Now I get saved. And this lawsuit's coming along, and I'm going to go through another round of depositions. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, if they ask me now about records, I'm going to have to say, yeah, I did find some. Well, where are they? First, send them. How's that going to look in front of a judge or a jury, right? Day the deposition comes. I'm upstairs. I'm praying, Lord, I want to tell the truth, but I don't know when I'm on that stand. With the pressure, if I will, I may fold, you know, I may fold. I don't know what to do. Give me the strength, you know. Phone rings, and it's my attorney, and he says, yeah, the deposition got canceled for today. It's like, oh, good. It's scheduled for like a week from now. All right,
boy,
whatever.
A week to think about it.
More praying, more other things like that. And over the succeeding amount of time, the lawsuit settled. But I never had to go be deposed again or go to the stand. And I know that was God's grace, that he kept me from being in a position where he knew my heart. I wanted to do the right thing, but he wouldn't test us beyond our ability, right? He keeps us from sin. And I'm so thankful for that. So anyway, he says, I did not let you touch her. Now, he did that for the king's sake. He also did that for Sarah and Abraham's sake. Remember, he's going to bring a child through Sarah and Abraham's union. If there's another man who's involved in that, maybe people question who's dad, you know, who's the dad of this kid really, right? So God was preserving the lineage of Isaac, and he was also keeping this man from committing a sin. I think when we peel back anything that God's doing, we're going to find layers upon layers upon layers of complexity. Now, our God is amazing. Nature teaches us a lot about the Creator. There's the old story about George Washington Carver, right? And he was a godly man, and he was very inquisitive and curious. And I believe the story goes that he prayed to God, I want to know everything about everything, you know? And God showed him the peanut and said, start here, you know? And he spent a lifetime studying the peanut and found out all kinds of stuff. And he dug and dug into it. And the more that he dug, the more that he found, and we'd see complexity upon complexity with our God. He's so deep. He's so big. And I think that's one of the things that's going to be amazing to us when we get to heaven. Things that we thought were inconsequential, small, didn't have any meaning, any purpose, we're going to find out that God did amazing things in them and through them. So God's working on all kinds of different levels here with Abimelech, keeping him from sin and also preserving the seed that he's going to bring through Abraham and Sarah. Verse 7, now therefore restore the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you and you shall live. But if you do not restore her, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours. So he's really the pressure on Abimelech here. He says, not only are you going to die, everybody in your family is going to die. You know, I was going to say, usually when you hear people say they're threatening to kill you and your family, right? Uh-huh. They're usually the people that you don't want to meet, you know, in the dark alley, you know, the drug lords or whatever like that. I mean, God's being very stern here, right? He says, restore the man's wife. He is a prophet. First time the word prophet is used in the Bible. He will pray for you and you shall live. If you do not restore, know that you shall surely die and all who are yours. So Abimelech rose early in the morning and called all his servants and told all these things in their hearing. And the men were very much afraid. And Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, what have you done to us? How have I offended you that you have brought on me and my kingdom great sin? Calls in Abraham and he basically says, what were you thinking? What were you doing? Very similar to remember what Pharaoh said as well. And Abimelech said to Abraham, what did you have in view that you have done this thing? And Abraham said, because I thought surely the fear of God is not in this place and they will kill me on the account of my wife. But indeed, she is truly my sister. She's the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. And she became my wife. And it came to pass when God caused me to wander from my father's house that I said to her, this is your kindness that you should do for me in every place, wherever we go. Say of me, he is my brother. He said, Abraham, what are you thinking? And he said, I thought that the fear of God is not in this place and they will kill me on account of my wife. He thought that the fear of God wasn't in that place. But what was he forgetting? That God has been with him the whole time, right? Mm-hmm. It didn't matter what those people thought. What mattered is that he was under the protection of God. After he came back from defeating the five kings, do you remember that story? And God, when he was afraid, came to him and appeared and he said, Abram, I'm your shield and your exceeding great reward, right? God was letting him know that I'm your protector. I'm the one keeping watch over you. I'm the one making sure that you are well taken care of. And Abraham, when he's going down to this new place, he's forgot that it's been the presence of God that's sustaining him. Now, Abraham is an incredibly faithful guy. Yet in this area of his life, there's weakness.
This was the second time he died.
This is the second time he's done it again. Now, all of us like to say, oh my goodness, Abraham, how could you? But I want you to actually take inventory of your own life. And you know that there are certain places where you have failed, and you failed on more than one occasion, and you've prayed about it, and you've thought about it, and you've asked God to deal with it, and yet you fail again.
I have a little footnote here.
Yeah.
It says God is working in us every day. It becomes more and more like him. But the process of sanctification is just that, a process. So it's a process for all of us.
So I don't know what it is in our own particular makeup. There are certain areas where you can trust God. And people would say, I don't know how you could believe God for that. I would be freaking out. And you go, I don't know. I just know. I have no worries about it. Not a care. And something else may come along, which to the rest of the world looks so small and you collapse.
It's true.
It's part of our makeup. I don't fully understand it. But this was a sore spot for Abraham.
Don't you think, too, it's like that personal relationship that we all have with him? You know, there's like, we're all on a different level, even though we're all aiming to that same goal. Right? We all have things that, like,
I mean,
you
Abraham,
may not fear what I fear.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
We are different. So, anyway, Abraham begins to make excuses, right? Because I didn't think the fear of God was in this place. Well, you had forgot that God was with you, right? Indeed, he's going to justify his lies. I really didn't lie to you. She is really my sister. She's the daughter of my father, not the daughter of my mother. Technically, she's my half-sister. You know, it's a half a lie. It was intended to deceive. So it's a lie. I know that there's a big difference you can be wrong about something and not lie, right? Mm-hmm. Someone could ask you a question, you could answer, and the answer is just wrong. But you weren't lying. That's what you thought. That was your honest thing, right? Lying is when you know you're wrong and you say it anyway. And here Abraham is trying to play a technicality. He's deceiving. We shouldn't do that. And then he comes down and he starts to blame God at verse 13. And it came to pass when God caused me to wander from my father's house that I said to her, this is your kindness that you should do for me in every place, wherever we go, say of me, he is my brother. He says, you know, God's got me wandering all around. And, you know, if I wasn't wandering all around, I wouldn't do this. But because we had to wander, right, I have to take this precaution. It's really God's fault. Now, I'm going to read you a quote from Dr. Donald Barnhouse about this word which Abraham uses here, wander. This is a terrible meaning. There is a terrible meaning in this verb, wander, which Abraham uses. The Hebrew word occurs exactly 50 times in the scripture and never in a good sense. It is used of animals going astray, of drunken men reeling or staggering, of sinful seduction, for prophets' lies causing the people to err, of the path of a lying heart. Six other words are translated wander, any one of which Abraham might have used, but he used the worst word available. Mm-hmm. Right? He's saying, God's got me staggering around like a drunk. I don't know where I'm going. He's blaming God here. Not so different than Adam when he was caught in the garden. That's that woman you gave me, Lord. You know, we were fine before you made her. You made her, now all the problems started, right?
It's the same word. I don't want to be a restless wandering to Canaan.
I don't know. So, again, we see that these are real people. And we don't, you know, I always see myself in this sense that a lot of times when I get called on the carpet, a lot of times we just don't want to admit it. I was wrong. What I did was wrong. We try to find some way to excuse ourselves. And this is what Raven's doing. And I know there's times in your life and in my life when we may not have said the words, but in our heart, we kind of blame God for something. You didn't put me here, God. If you didn't allow that thing to happen, I never would have done X, Y, and Z. So this is that agreement. Wherever we go, he's supposed to say he's my brother, not my wife. Then Abimelech took sheep and oxen and male and female servants and gave them to Abraham, and he restored Sarah, his wife, to him. And Abimelech said, see, my land is before you, dwell where it pleases you. Then to Sarah, he said, behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Indeed, this vindicates you before all who are with you and before everybody. Thus, he said, he was rebuked. So Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech, his wife, and his female servants, and they bore children. For the Lord had closed up all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. These last few verses give us the impression that there was some decent amount of time when Sarah was taken away from Abraham. Again, this just didn't happen one day, and the dream was the next. But he had closed up all the wombs. Nobody could have children. That's not anything you would notice in a day, you know? This had to be over some period of time. But I want to look at what Abimelech says here in verses 15 down through 16. He said to Abraham, here's my land, is before you, dwell wherever it pleases you. He welcomes him down into the land. God's still working grace on Abraham's behalf. This king, somebody, you know, he was done wrong by Abraham. You think he would have said, get out of my land. Isn't that what Pharaoh said? Leave. Remember, right? Here he says, you can stay. You can stay. That's God's grace. Because God told Abraham that this was his land. He could dwell in it, right? When he was in Egypt, that wasn't his land. He got kicked out of there, back to where God knew he should be. And here, God's given him grace to stay in the land which God had promised him. Then he says to Sarah, behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Notice how he refers to Abraham here. Your brother. Kind of like digging it in a little bit there, you know, your husband, I mean brother, I mean husband, I'm not sure. He gives 1,000 pieces of silver. This is to vindicate you. And I guess this was a sign to let him know that he was making a full restitution, that he hadn't touched Sarah, hurt Sarah. Her reputation was still intact, you know, that she can go back to being a wife without any tarnish on that relationship. Abraham then prays to God. Abraham does his part as the prophet. Prophet, bringing the word of God to the people, and in this case, praying on behalf of the people. And God heals Abimelech's wife, his female servants, and they began to bore their children again, for the Lord had closed up all the wounds of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. Question on Donna? Yeah.
Yes, my brother. I don't see how the last two verses, 17 and 18, they don't make sense to me. He allowed the women to have to bear children, and then he closed up the wombs of them?
No, for the Lord had closed up the wombs, past tense.
Oh.
It was happening when Abraham prayed, God then opened up the womb so they could go back to bearing.
Thank you.
Any other questions? We're pausing here. Jumping down, there's Anthony.
I don't understand 2016, the second part. Behold, he is given a covering of tithes unto all of the wealthy with whole mother.
Okay. It's a little translated a little bit differently in the New King James. Let me read it from there. Maybe it'll be a little easier to understand. Then he said to Sarah, behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Indeed, this vindicates you.
Okay.
Before all who are with you and before everybody. That's the idea.
Okay, God.
Yeah, my translation says, it is a sign of your innocence in the eyes of all who are with you.
And he talks about it being a covering of the eyes. The idea was when the female would wear the veil, it was a sign of their innocence, their protection, right, like that. Mm. He's basically saying, this is kind of showing that you were innocent, you weren't taken advantage of, you know. So that's the idea. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm listening to this, and I'm not going to say, I'm not going to say, that's not my decision, right? But they always come up with this idea of the dead rebuking you.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we as Christians, at the time of the unsaved, so is that what a Christian says? Is that what a Christian does? That's the dead rebuking Christian. If Balaam had the donkey rebuke him, God uses the unsaved sometimes to rebuke us. And that's what's happening right here. And I'm going to say Abimelech, I don't know, maybe talk or anything. But I picture it as being rebuked by a dead man. Spiritually, he's dead, and yet he knows right from wrong, and you don't. I mean, that is not a good situation to be in. And you know, I've been there, I know. When you're doing something, you say something you shouldn't say. An unsaved person says, is that what a Christian says? Mm-hmm. You go, wow, I'll be rebuked by the dead. How far have I moved from where I should be that a dead man has to rebuke me? That's not the place you want to be.
So for the second time, God swoops in when Abraham errs and saves him. We're only told about two times this happens to Abraham. Again, I mentioned, if we look at our own life, we probably have examples way more than two where we've fallen into maybe the same trap over and over again. And God faithfully has rescued us over and over and over again. And one of the things that I will say about the kindness of God is that he rarely, if ever, throws it in our face. Sometimes he'll remind us, remember this? Think about it, you know? But he doesn't come back and go, boy, you just stink, you know? He doesn't do that. He loves us. He knows us. There's the idea, and because of God's foreknowledge and God knowing everything before it ever happens, right? People say, you know, you can't disappoint God, right? Because he never has an expectation that you're not going to live up to. He knows who you are. He knows who you were before you were born. Remember, he says in the Psalms, the Holy Spirit, right? Every day of your life is already written down in the book, you know, before they even happen. He knows. And knowing all of that, he still decided to save us. Knowing all the times before I was saved that you would go against his law and curse his name, take him for granted, make jokes about him, that he still loved us. That before the foundation of the world, the plan of salvation was already in place. Jesus would die for those who were unworthy. That's the love of God, isn't it?
Amen.
Chapter 21, shall we press on? And the Lord visited Sarah. You notice I didn't wait for you to answer. And the Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had spoken. We can have a whole sermon right on that verse there. The Lord visited Sarah as he had said. God said it, he did it. And the Lord did for Sarah as he had spoken. What he does is exactly what he says. So when God says it, he will do it. And when he does it, it's exactly what he says. Mm-hmm. That's a very important verse, actually, for interpreting prophecy.
That's good.
Okay. Why is it an important verse for interpreting prophecy? Because prophecy isn't really clear to us until after it happens and it's fulfilled. Right. Then we go, oh, that's how it happened. When we look at future prophecy, many times there's areas where we look and we go, how is this exactly going to happen? So we look in Ezekiel 38, right? God talks about a future war, the war of Gog and Magog, right? How they're going to come down out of the north. They're going to invade Israel in the land, and how they're going to be rebuked by God, pushed back by God himself, God fighting the battle. And they're going to be, you know, picking up all the debris from this battle for years and years and all this other stuff. And people have looked and they said, okay, well, who are these nations that are coming down? Well, Gog must be this one and Magog must be this one. Garmin, these are the other nations that are there, and they pick out all these people who will be part of this battle. The problem is, we don't know when this battle is going to come. If it happened now, the nations that people are naming could be the nations that will form that confederacy. But if God, for in his divine knowledge, delayed for a millennium more, who even knows if any of those nations are still going to be existing or fall by that name? What he says is that he's going to draw these nations down from the north of Israel. So I know that they're going to come from the north of Israel. That's what we know. We know what he said. And what he said will happen. But if we, anything beyond exactly what he says, it's just inference by us. It's just opinion by us. So we have to look at prophecy and say, like what Jesus says, he's going to on with this, you know, for the church, right? The shout of the archangel, the trump of God, right? That's exactly what's going to happen. We know it because the word says it. Everything else that isn't explicitly said is just our best guess, you know? So when we're looking at prophecy, oh, you may hear me say this if we get into other parts where we're teaching prophecy. I don't know exactly how this will work out, but I know that everything God said is exactly what's going to happen. You know, people try to figure out in the tribulation period, how's this going to work? How's that going to work? I don't know how it's going to work. I don't know how, you know, one third of the waters are going to turn to blood and how this is going to happen and how people are going to survive after this or exactly what the occurrence of events is. But I know everything he says is 100% accurate. God said what he was going to do, he did, and he did exactly for Sarah what he had spoken. For the Sarah conceived and bore Abram a son in his old age, at a set time of which God had spoken to him. God did it. Sarah and Abraham cooperated with him by faith because they had to believe enough to still come together to produce a child. They still had to believe that it was possible. Again, God's telling us to do things, and many times we cooperating in him to bring forth the plan that he's desired. And Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore to him, Isaac. Isaac. That's the name that God gave him. What does everybody remember what Isaac means?
Laughter,
right?
Laughter, right?
And Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old in obedience to God's command, right? As God had commanded him. Now, Abram was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. And Sarah said, God has made me laugh. All who hear will laugh with me. She also said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? For I have borne him a son in his old age. Couple important things here. Remember, when God told Abraham that if Sarah was going to bear a son, remember, Abraham left, right? And basically God was like, is anything too hard for me? You know? And then he says it again in Sarah's hearing when she's inside the tent, when he's on his way to visit Sodom and Gomorrah. And Sarah laughs and she says, oh, right. You know, kind of a laughing in disbelief. And God says, you know, why is Sarah laughing? And she goes, I didn't laugh. Remember that? There was all this laughing around his name. And now there's more laughter. But now the promise has come. And the laughter is pure joy now. So many times for us, when God gives us promises, we're going to react a little bit like Abraham. We're going to react sometimes a little bit like Sarah. Sometimes God's going to tell us something and we're going to be like, it's the best thing ever. I don't understand how it could happen, but it's blowing my mind. You know, I'm believing as much as I can. I still don't fully understand it, but we're partially there in faith. Other times God makes us a promise and we go, yeah, right. No, it's not going to happen. We have experienced both of those things. But I'll tell you what we also experience. When God brings that promise to fruition, there is a joy that overflows us. You know, right now, if I ask everybody in this room, right, does everybody here have a relationship with Jesus Christ? Probably everybody would raise their hand, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, does everybody believe you're going to heaven, right?
Yes.
We all say, yes, I believe you're going to heaven. Yes. When you actually go to heaven, right, you're going to believe it in a different way, you know? Because faith has now turned into sight. And we're going to experience, oh my goodness, this is so wonderful. And that's where Sarah is now. She's got real laughter and joy at the work that God has done. She's rejoicing in it. And now, look at what she says. She says, God has made me laugh, and all who hear it will laugh with me. Who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? For I've borne him a son in his old age. She's not only capable of bearing the child, she's capable of now nursing the child. There has been a refreshing that's been done to Sarah here. And that's a wonderful thing. God makes us all a promise about getting a new body, getting the resurrection body, the body like Jesus had after he came out of the tomb, that will be made, as Paul says, like unto his glorious body. And the older I get, the more I appreciate that particular promise. It's a wonderful thing to know that that this mortal will put on immortality. Yeah. And I am looking forward to it. No more contacts then, Fran. It's going to be great.
So she has her glasses on.
Yeah.
Well, these are to read the Christmas I can't read. And you have to even double glasses. You have to test.
Verse 8. So the child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made him a great feast on the same day that Isaac was weaned. We don't know exactly how old he was at this point. You know, some people say he weren't weaned till 12. That sounds really extreme to me to be weaned. Some say 5. The consensus number is about 3 years old. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had bore to Abraham, scoffing. This is Ishmael. Therefore, she said to Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, namely with Isaac. And the matter was very displeasing in Abraham's sight because of his son. So Ishmael is doing something to Isaac, teasing, mocking, and Sarah sees it, and she is not going to have any of this.
She's not laughing.
And she says to Abraham, get rid of this kid. He can't stay here. He won't inherit with Isaac. Abraham was very displeased. It's his son. You know? I'm sure Isaac is going to be now probably about 13, I think, years old here. He's 13 years. He's lived with this boy, you know. And it's his son. And he says, get out. He doesn't want to let him go. So he's in the middle of a pickle here. Verse 12, and God said to Abraham, do not let it be displeasing in your sight because of the lad or because of your bondwoman. Whatever Sarah has said to you, listen to her voice, for in Isaac your seed shall be called. God comes in and mediates this dispute between him and Sarah. And don't think that as Christian husband and wife, that there's never going to be a time when there's disagreement in a household. It happens. Don't think that you're not going to need God sometimes to get in the middle and settle something. I've experienced it in my own life. And God has a wonderful way of being able to bring us together when we couldn't really do it on our own. And in this instance, he says, listen to your wife. Do what she says, right? I know there's probably a lot of people that would like to make this a hard, fast rule, a doctrine. Husbands, listen to your wife. There's other places where it says, don't listen to your wife, right? Because wives, like husbands, are not perfect. We don't always get it right. When we get it right is when we are listening to God and being led by God. Then husbands usually get it right. Wives usually get it right. And in this instance, he says, listen to your voice. And he deals with Abraham's feeling. Don't be worried about the lad. Don't let it be displeasing because of the boy, because of the bondwoman, because of Hagar. Hagar ran away once already, came back. She's been part of that family for a long time now. I'm sure, you know, that he liked Hagar. Yeah? She was part of the family too. Don't worry, God says. Whatever Sarah said to you, listen to her voice, for in Isaac your seed shall be called. It's important. And Isaac is going to be the one through the line, through that promise that I gave you of those who curse you will be cursed, those who bless you will be blessed, right? This is all coming through the seed of Isaac. Yet I will also make a nation of the son of God, woman, because he is your seed. Interesting that God uses the same terminology that Sarah does in referring to Hagar as the bondwoman, right? It's going to become an important doctrinal statement for Paul later on when he differentiates for us the idea of grace versus works or the law. That if you're following the law and you believe that the law will save you, you are still in bondage to the law. And he uses the same comparison between Sarah and Hagar being the law, the bondwoman, and Sarah being the example of promise or grace in that instance. God echoes that same term here when he talks to Hagar as the bondwoman. So Abraham rose early in the morning and took bread, skin of water, and putting it on her shoulder, he gave it, and the boy to Hagar, and sent her away. Then she departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. And the water in the skin was used up, and she placed the boy under one of the shrubs, and she went and sat down across from him at a distance of about a bow shot, 100 yards or so, something like that. For she said to herself, let me not see the death of the boy. So she sat opposite him and lifted up her voice and wept. And God heard the voice of the lad. Then the angel of God called to Hagar out of heaven and said to her, what ails you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad and hold him with your hand, for I will make him a great nation. And God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. And she went and filled the skin with water and gave the lad a drink. So God was with the lad, and he grew, and he dwelt in the wilderness and became an archer. He dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt. Hmm. So we have the story now of Hagar and Isaac and Ishmael departing once again from Abraham. This time she's not running away. This time she's sent away according to the plan of God. Abraham, when he sends him away, he rises early in the morning. This is going to be a characteristic of Abraham. Mostly when God says do something, Abraham does it right away. It's great advice. God tells you to do something, do it really quickly. Why? The longer you wait, the longer you allow your mind, the whispering of the enemy, to blunt the momentum, blunt the purpose that God has given you. Best thing we can do when we hear from God is to obey immediately. But he does something here, which I still don't quite understand it. Abraham is a very rich guy. He's sending them away. He loves them. He was so displeased about the idea of sending them away. And now when he sends them away, he gives them a little bit of bread and one skin of water. And he's sending them out into the wilderness. You know, you would think it sent a couple camels, some servants. We'll get you here. We'll get you there. He doesn't do that at all. Why? Is Abraham, you know, greedy? We don't see that from him. He turns away riches in other instances. He doesn't seem a man who's greedy for anything. Was that part of the plan of God? He told Abraham, this is how I want you to do it. I don't know. The scripture doesn't tell us. I would lean there from my own understanding, because we're going to see that this gives us another place where God can intersect in their life. That there's a need that God fills. And by filling that need, God gives them a better understanding of who they are and God's care for them. That would mean that God then manufactures a time need in our life. I think we see that in scripture. So that he could reveal himself through that need. Not every hard place we get to in life is because we've sinned, because of our own fault. Sometimes the hard places are put in our path by God so that God, through that, can expand our faith and our knowledge of him. Many examples of that in the scriptures. Yes.
Well, I'm reading this and seeing it. He would have no part in there.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really taking it to the extremes.
You get nothing. You get a few skin and just water.
The goal that Abraham had was Isaac's. Take it to the extreme, but you kind of see where Abraham treated him not as an heir, but as a stranger in your home. He put it even more for the stranger.
Yeah.
But because he was told by God to do everything Abraham that Sarah said, and, you know, Abraham did everything, which meant he had no part in the inheritance at all. If he had given him part of the inheritance of Isaac, that would not have been total obedience. So I'm thinking he really just did exactly what he was told, no part of the inheritance at all. You know.
Except we really know what the inheritance of Isaac was. Wasn't the stuff, right? It was the promise that was the real inheritance. But your point is valid in what you're saying. Okay, so now they go out. The water runs out, and they're lost in the wilderness. They're thirsty. They're dying from dehydration. She puts Ishmael under a bush. She doesn't want to see him die. She goes a short distance away. She's crying. And verse 17 says, God heard the voice of the lad. Interesting. Ishmael was praying. Before it was Hagar who was praying. Well, Hagar is just crying, but Ishmael's praying. And the angel of God calls out to Hagar out of heaven and says to her, what ails you, Hagar? Interesting question. What's the problem? Don't be afraid, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. And he says, now take him up, right? I'm going to make him a great nation. You remember, he reiterates that promise. And look at verse 19. Then God opened her eyes and she saw a well of water. It doesn't say that God miraculously made a well of water. It says God opened up her eyes so she could see it. That right there was what she needed, but she couldn't see it. How many times in our own way we look at things, we miss the obvious solution to our problem? And God has to sometimes just open up our eyes to something that was right there in front of us. And there was that well right there for her. Now, God had brought her to that place. He opened up her eyes. She fills the skin with water, gives the lad a drink. And God was with the lad, and he grew and dwelt in the wilderness, became an archer. He gets a wife from Egypt. God isn't against Hagar and Ishmael. He doesn't hate them. He has a plan for them, He cares for them. He watches over them. That wasn't the blind through which he would come. They weren't part of that promise, but neither were we part of that line. And God had a plan for us and cares for us and provides for us, right? Because God is good. He loves everybody. He doesn't just say, oh, I only like Abraham and his family. No, he was watching over Hagar, was watching over Ishmael as well. We can't finish. I'd like that. Can we get 5 minutes? It's not really that much more. Are we okay to go 5 minutes more? Yeah? Okay, great. But it came to pass at that time that Abimelech and Phicol. Now, some people say this is not the same Abimelech. This is a different Abimelech. I don't know. because I don't know exactly how much more time has passed. It seems like it's pretty close together in time here, less than a year. Could be the same guy, might be a different guy. We know that this is the king in that area, and Phicol, the commander of his army, they come out and they speak to Abraham, saying, God is with you in all that you do. They've been watching Abraham, and they notice something about him, that God is with him. I pray that when the world looks at us, they would notice that God is with us. It's important. How do they know it? Abraham, well, I mean, God told them, you know, he's a prophet. So he had an endorsement from God. But I think they also watched the way he lived. They were watching what was going on, and they saw the blessing of God in their life. Okay, God is with you now. Therefore, swear to me by God that you will not deal falsely with me, with my offspring, or with my posterity, but that according to the kindness that I have done to you, you will do to me and to the land in which you have fallen. He basically wants a treaty with him. He wants to say, listen, you know, I've been good to you. I know God is with you. I want you to promise that you're going to be good to us too. And Abraham said, I will swear. Abraham was willing to live at peace with the people that were around him. Another good example for we as Christians. We are pilgrims in this world. This is not our home. We are not told to be territorial here, to live at peace with all men as much as we can on our right? Because some people will not live at peace with you. Your requirement is you, as much as you can, as much as you are able, you live at peace with them. Abraham said, yeah, I'll swear. And Abraham rebuked Abimelech because of a well of water, which Abimelech's servants had seized. He says, okay, we're going to be at peace, but I need you to know something. Your guys stole a well from me. And Abimelech said, I don't know who has done this thing. You didn't tell me, nor had I heard of it until today. Basically, it's news to me. So Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them to Abimelech, and the two of them made a covenant. And Abraham set seven ewe lambs of the flock by themselves. And Abimelech asked Abraham, what is the meaning of these seven ewe lambs which you have set by themselves? And he said, you will take these seven ewe lambs from my hand, that they may be a witness that I have dug this well. So Abraham is making him acknowledge Abraham's right to the water there. This was not a minor thing to negotiate. This is a place where water, there's no big rivers running down here. Water was basically found through wells. You found a well of water, it was a major resource. You're going to see this well come up more in scripture again. We're going to see Isaac unblocking this well later on. Jacob will pass by this well. This will pop up a few more if you just keep your eye out for it. But Abraham, it said if there needed to be peace, they needed to reconcile some of the disagreements there. If you're going to be at peace with somebody, some of the old things can't just be buried because they have a way of resurfacing on their own. Some of those things that cause the friction need to be dealt with. That's a challenge. A lot of times we like to avoid that because we like to avoid confrontation, but rarely does that work in the long run. Sometimes you have to get to the heart of things in a good way, being unafraid to deal with them. This is what Abraham does here. Okay, to be at peace, let's clear the air. And he now shows them, you know, this is the well that I dug. Here's an acknowledgement. You're going to acknowledge, yes, this is your well. And they call this place Beersheba because the two of them swore an oath there. The well of the oath, a lot of people like to say that's what Beersheba means. Some people interpret it a little bit differently. But it seems to make sense from the context of the story too, right? Talking about a well, dispute over the well, and the promise that they made, the covenant that they made. So they made a covenant at Beersheba, and Abimelech rose with Phicol, the commander of his army, and they returned to the land of the Philistines. Now, there are no Philistines in the land yet. Huh. Okay? The Philistines won't inhabit this place, the people from that region, until later. But Moses, in writing this book, is giving his readers a way to identify what portion of the land is. Remember, because he's going to be writing this to the people in his day that were coming out of Egypt, that were going into the promised land, right? Where the Philistine was, they would understand whose territory he's talking about here. That would be like, you know, if I was referring to something saying and said, you know, this is Ocean City, New Jersey, right? We all know what Ocean City, New Jersey is. But if it was several hundred years ago, it wasn't called Ocean City, New Jersey. It had a whole different name, you know? If I gave you the name from a few hundred years ago, you'd go, where? Who? Where's that place? So it helped them to understand and to reference that place. Okay. So they returned to the land of the Philistines. Then Abraham planted a tamarisk tree in Beersheba, and there called on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. And Abraham stayed in the land of the Philistines many days. After this is settled, Abraham plants some trees there in Beersheba, a tamarisk tree. Tamarisk trees are known to be extremely slow-growing trees.
Huh.
You don't plant a tamarisk tree if you think you're leaving the next week. You know, Abraham was understanding the promise of God. He was believing that the land was his. He was working on improving the land. And it didn't matter if it would take 100 years for the trees to grow, because it was going to be land that God promised. He was walking in the knowledge of the promise of God, and his actions were showing. One of the things that God asks of us as believers is to give our time, give our talents, give our treasure, to give what he gave us back to him so that he can use it to let his kingdom grow, right? To let his work go. If we believe the promises of God, and if we believe the importance of the work that he's left us here to do, then we will freely give for things that we may not see a return on in our lifetime here. You know, we will give money, we'll give properties, we'll give everything else like that. Understanding that God's not going to waste any of it. He's going to use it, and he's going to bring from it fruit. We can give so freely, not worrying about it, because what's most important to us is that we walk in the promise that he's given us. And this is what Abraham did. I can plant trees that are going to take 100 years. I may not see them. When I come back, I'll see them. You know, he had this hope in the promise of God, and that allowed him then to do things that were beyond the scope of his lifetime or his normal, what he would consider his needs. And I believe that's something that we can all learn lessons from as well. Thank you for indulging me. I took 7 minutes, but we finished the chapter, and that's good. That's chapter 22. It's a pretty important chapter. To get to it, please read ahead next week. And it's good that we can take that as a whole. Questions? Comments?
It's interesting. Like he says, you're a man of integrity or whatever. And he says, so don't lie to us.
Yeah.
Oh, I've got a reputation for that.
I remember, right? Okay. Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you, Lord, that you watch over us, care for us. Thank you that when we do things wrong, Lord, you bail us out. That doesn't give us license to sin. But we are so grateful, Lord, that you don't give us what we deserve. Rather, you give us what we don't deserve, your love, your devotion. And we are grateful, Lord. We pray, Father, that we would be faithful like Abraham was faithful, that we would grow each day, dear Lord, to trust you more and to seek, dear God, your plan out. And to sacrifice, dear Lord, even some of the things that we think could help us today for what you have promised for the future, knowing that that's far better. So, Lord, equip us. Be your kids doing your work here, and give us your joy, your peace, and just bless, dear God, bless the work. We desire, dear Lord, that it would please you. We ask it in Jesus' name.